Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 12th of July 2015. My name is TRP Watson and this week I'm joined by Julie Raby, Johnny Fox, Nick from Partnership's Rocket View and Gareth James. We're now going to talk about As You Like It at Shakespeare's Globe. This production is directed by Blanche McIntyre and stars Michelle Terry as Rosalind. And, of course, has the great Globe stager, James Garnon, as Jaques. So, all in all, it should be interesting. Julie, tell me more about this production and what you thought of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think being in the Globe, I found the production very comic because the recent productions of As You Like It I've seen tend to bring out the dark side of the play. Of course, it is a comedy, but recent productions have brought out the dark side of the play and possibly more of a love story between Rosalind and Orlando. What I found with this production was that they played up every moment for comedy and sometimes over the top, which I think is fine in the Globe because it's such a big space to fill. So I felt, for example, Michelle Terry was brilliant as Rosalind, but also Ellie Pearcey played a very energetic Celia, because sometimes Celia's a bit more serious and a bit more of a foil for Rosalind. But I felt Ellie Pearcey was so kind of lively as well, both in the court and the forest. And I was thinking a little bit about this, and I was wondering whether it's because both of them, Michelle Terry and Ellie Pearcey, have both just recently played Beatrice, Michelle Terry at the Royal Shakespeare Company and Ellie Pearcey up at the Manchester Royal Exchange in Maria Arberg's production last year of Much Ado. And so coming into this production, they've got a real sense of women taking control and taking ownership of the situation. And for me, this was one of the things that really struck me. So in As You Like It, you get the court scene where Rosalind meets Orlando in the wrestling match. And it's Orlando that kind of shines in that wrestling match, as it looks as if he's going to get beaten to a pulp by the wrestler, Charles the Wrestler. But he wins in the end. In this production, it felt very much like it was Rosalind that made it happen. There was a kind of gesture that had been going on with Charles the Wrestler in the audience, and she repeats that gesture. And it's as if she's just taken control of the situation and kind of won the wrestling match for Orlando. So there was very much a sense of the women being in control, both through the court and at the end. And I quite like the nice touch at the end where Rosalind still had the breeches at the end. I thought that was quite a nice touch. What I didn't really feel about it was Orlando having that sense of, and Rosalind having a real kind of being in love with each other. It was an attraction, but I didn't get a sense of them being madly deeply in love, which I've got from recent productions of the play. There was a really funny moment. I know it was funny because I could hear the audience laughing with a dance towards the end of the play with Audrey the Shepherdess. And because the reason I couldn't see it was because it was between the two posts, and I did have a restricted view seat, so you expect to have your view blurred. But the whole thing, all I could see was the audience laughing, really laughing, and not being able to see any of it happening. And I just thought maybe they could have moved away from the position just to give other people a bit of a sense, those people sat on the sides, a sense of what was going on. I think that it was quite interesting the way that they put this production in the, you know, Elizabethan Jacobean dress, but there were so many anachronistic moments, certain gestures that you just wouldn't have got in the period, the inclusion of a map, etc., that actually made the production interesting, and it worked really well in that space. I don't know what you thought, Tim.
Yeah, I enjoy Shakespeare, and this is a well-done production, I think, and I do enjoy Shakespeare at the Globe. The problem I think I had with it is that I wasn't excited enough by this production. Perhaps it's because I've seen an awful lot of them recently, an awful lot of As You Like It recently, and it takes a lot to excite me. But although I have to mention the production that I saw last year at the Southwark Playhouse, which was a very little production done mainly by people who are better known for musical theatre, and it was actually quite a fresh take on the piece. It was quite a fresh take on the whole play. This didn't feel fresh enough. I mean, it were little bits and pieces and the anachronisms you mention, but it did feel to me a little bit by the book, and in a way I was a little bit disappointed by that, because there's nothing wrong with what they did, and I think, you know, it's a fine production, but I wanted more excitement. I wanted there to be more to seeing Michelle Terry doing this part, which is, you know, a very important Shakespearean part for people, and I didn't feel that enough. I didn't feel the characterizations enough, and I think also, I mean, slightly, I wasn't entirely happy with Daniel Crossley's Touchstone, and I've already mentioned James Garner as Jaques, and somehow I wanted there to be more to that, and there wasn't, and I did find myself a little bit disappointed by that. There is very little wrong with this production. It's very fine. It's a good production, and the Globe are doing good Shakespeare. But I just was not electrified by this, and I really want to be electrified by stuff I see at the Globe. And one of the things, they have settled a little bit too much into doing what they call original practices productions. I mean, we see an awful lot of those at the Globe, where they are dressing in Elizabethan or Jacobean dress. We're not seeing sort of them step outside that and really go into some of the more difficult areas that they've been. I mean, some of the stuff at the Globe, certainly under Mark Rylance, was incredibly experimental. And although often they would completely ruin a play by doing that, you know, having a three-person Tempest, for example, where the three actors are always in a circle of rope. That was odd and strange and probably wrecked the play for an awful lot of people. But I would like to see something between that and this, which, you know, it's just, it's quality, but I want more than that from the Globe, I think. And, I mean, it's one of the, a pity that this sort of thing, you know, Dominic Drumgoole's not going out on a sort of more fiery and more experimental side to things. Because I certainly think some of the earlier ones that he's done in his time have been a lot more exciting. And I don't know that I've been excited. It's perhaps just me not being excited, because I think overall this has got very good reviews. And as I say, it's a treat to see people like Michelle Terry doing Rosalind. But I wasn't turned on enough, I think.
Yeah, I agree. I think, though, it's the space, isn't it, and the time of year, and it's kind of playing up to maybe a tourist audience more than some of the other productions that have been on recently. I think it works for that particular moment, that audience, but I do agree they're not really getting into the depth of the play. I think they're playing the surface of it very much. So I do agree with a lot that you're saying. Yeah, good production, but, you know, lacks the wow factor, I would say.
We're now going to talk about The Importance of Being Earnest. This is a production of Oscar Wilde's play, which stars David Suchet as Lady Bracknell. And it's directed by Adrian Noble, with Michael Benz, Philip Cumbus, Emily Barber, Imogen Dole, Michelle Dotris, Richard O'Callaghan, David Killick, and Brendan Hooper. It is rather strange to have the leading character part, I suppose, as a man in drag, especially when you have the likes of, well, Celia Imrie or Deborah Findlay around. Of course, neither of those, excellent as they are, have the cachet of Suchet or the ability to get people in to see this play. It has suffered in the last couple of years with getting strange people doing things with it. There's the very odd one that ran in the West End last year, where you had a superannuated cast, which included Nigel Havers and Martin Jarvis, who had first done it in 1981-ish, alongside Judi Dench as Lady Bracknell, although I think Judi Dench and Martin Jarvis are about the same age. In the West End, there was a very plush production done at the Haymarket in 1999 with Patricia Routledge, And more recently, about 7 years ago, there was a production at, I think it was the Vaudeville Theatre, which starred Penelope Keith and a young Harry Haddon Payton. So, you know, it's a bit of an old war horse, this play. It does seem to be bomb-proof, although people do seem to be trying to bomb it at the moment. But whatever production you see, everybody compares it to the 1950s film, which starred Michael Denison, Michael Redgrave, Dorothy Chutin, Joan Greenwood, and Edith Evans, and Miles Mallison and Margaret Rutherford as well. I mean, we can remember that cast. Watching, I have to say, watching this particular production, I kept thinking that film was very nearly perfect, and that's probably a terrible burden for a play to have to suffer under. John, tell me more about this production and what you thought of it.
Well, just picking up on what you said, I think you're right. I think people feel obliged to do the play as well and as classically and as accurately to the period as they can manage, but also to do something to break the restrictions of the movie, of the Edith Evans movie particularly. And I've seen, for example, Irene Handel play Lady Bracknell as a sort of middle European refugee going, you know, a hint big, which was a different sort of reading. And I think Patricia Routledge did it in a Yorkshire accent. I could be wrong about that, but she wasn't quite as posh as Lady Bracknell sometimes is. And I have seen some very strange recent productions. You mentioned the one with Sean Phillips, who I thought was very good, actually, despite the fact she's pushing 90 to play Lady B. And, you know, the rest of the cast were more broad in what they were doing. But she was quite an accurate version, I felt. Although it's very debatable how old is Lady Bracknell, because I think Edith Evans was only 44 when she played it in the film. So she was barely old enough to be Joan Greenwood's mother. This one, though, mystifies me even more than, for example, Vicky Michelle from Allo Allo playing it at Frinton Summer Theatre last year, where I knew more of the lines than she did. I tried to work out why this production was being put on. It must be David Suchet's own preference, because, you know, he is a writer, he is a performer of such a pedigree that he can write his own ticket. And, you know, if he says, I'd like to be in this play, then directors will fall over themselves to indulge him. But, you know, he's a television detective. His West End appearances are fairly few and far between. So it's a little bit like Angela Lansbury, you know, returning after having been Jessica Fletcher for 1,000 years to play, you know, one very notable Noel Coward part in the West End. And I think but the difference is that had anybody been casting a well-funded version of Blythe Spirit, they may well have thought of Angela Lansbury for the part. But if you're casting a well-funded revival of The Importance of Being Earnest, you wouldn't think of David Suchet for Lady Bracknell any quicker than you'd think of Angela Lansbury to play King Lear. It is completely wrong. And I think he's emboldened to do it because Geoffrey Rush, guy from the King's Speech film, did it so well in Australia. But mostly, I believe, because of Brian Bedford, an English actor who has had most of his career in the United States, who scored a huge success at the Stratford Ontario Festival with it and then brought it to Broadway, where it ran for a very long time to very full houses and great acclaim, proving, if you like, that a man can play this very indomitable woman quite successfully. But there is a difference. I've seen clips of Brian Bedford doing it, and you do not realize necessarily that it is a man in a frock. And Suchet doesn't achieve that. And I think the failing of this production is that nobody wants to piss on Poirot's chips, but it really isn't very good because he never gets past that barrier. And you are always aware not only that it is a man in a frock, but that it's Poirot in a frock, because a lot of the mannerisms and a lot of the wry glances and the secret smiles that he gives himself in Poirot are apparent in his rendition of Lady Bracknell as well. So I enjoyed the evening, and it's interesting to see, but it's more like going to the Waxworks than going to theatre. So what you're left with, really, is how do you fill in the gaps between Lady Bracknell's appearances? Because she only really turns up for two major scenes, the one in which she questions Jack Worthing about his suitability to be her daughter's husband, or daughter's fiancé, and then later when she comes back, when they're at the country house, having travelled down by train to expose the plot and discover that he is, in fact, her nephew. And the way Adrian Noble fills it is to turn it into a bit of a knockabout farce. It's pretty clear that whatever salary was squandered on Suchet didn't leave a great deal for hiring anybody else. And although the two young men have some track record largely at places like Shakespeare's Globe, they seem to have some Shakespearean experience, they're not really kind of names that would pull anybody into the theatre. So they are selling this purely on the Suchet name, and everybody else is quite secondary. And of the two girls, one of them is straight out of drama school, the one playing Gwendolyn, I think, and Imogen Dole has 5 or 6 years' experience, but also is quite ingenue-like in her performance. So yes, you have Emily Barber playing Gwendolyn, and she might be straight out of drama school, but she has all the pert confidence. Imogen Dole has been encouraged by Adrian Noble, I think, to play Cecily as a slightly too naive, too countrified, unschooled girl. I mean, she's so sort of teenage and desperate to have a crush on somebody. You'd think she'd just come from a Taylor Swift concert rather than been educated by her governess, Miss Prism. So it feels very non-period. And the boys also are encouraged to have a sort of knockabout play between them. And there's a tussle over a plate of muffins that is so stagey and so Brian Rixey that really it achieves the status of the sardines in Noises Off. It's that sort of nonsense. And you wonder whether that actually serves the Wild Text well enough. It's funny, the audience definitely like it, but I think as with so many revivals of plays that have been around for as long as this one, it works best if you don't know it. If you've never been to The Importance of Being Earnest, this is a great production. If you've seen 20 or 30 or 40 of them, like perhaps a lot of critics have, it wears a bit thin, really, and you begin to wonder why you've gone. Sorry, I didn't mention the boys by name, did I? Philip Cumbers plays Algernon, and I liked him. I thought he really got the character quite early on, and he is the one who drives the plot. Although Michael Benz's Jack Worthing is also young and cultish and playful, and I felt that either they needed somebody else to play Jack Worthing who could have the authority, because Jack is meant to be a bit po-faced, and he's the one that's always correcting Algy and telling him off for being you young scoundrel or you young scamp or something like that. But, you know, Benz looks the younger of the two characters. So either they're cast the wrong way around, or they needed a more dignified Jack Worthing to make it seem more convincing. So as I said, they're sort of playing to the gallery, and certainly through the long second act where Lady Bracknell doesn't appear, I think in order to stop the audience fidgeting, it has been camped up rather a lot, maybe rather too much. But playing to the same gallery are Michelle Dautrice and Richard O'Callaghan as the governess Miss Prism and her celibate suitor, Dr. Chasuble. And you could argue they ought to know better, because although I think Richard O'Callaghan does the canon extremely well, he's dishevelled and a bit distracted, and you sense he's not really quite all there. And that's a new and engaging reading of the part. But he gets the lines right. Whereas Michelle Dautrice has been encouraged to play Miss Prism also as a bit batty and a bit scatty and a bit girlish, especially when talking to the canon, that she fractures too many of the lines and the text isn't there. And I think hers is a slightly less elegant performance than it could be. I think she's very near to making an original Miss Prism, but not quite. The sets are very good, very elaborate detailing, very elaborate architectural detailing. And of course, you know, three completely separate sets requiring two variably lengthy intervals, whereas I think in the Sean Phillips version they did it all in a composite country house and garden set, which was very sort of arts and craftsy and very beautiful. This one looks more operatic. I felt that the garden with its manicured trees and its astroturf lawn really looked a bit ready for the Magic Flute, because the other thing that they do is it's very underpopulated with furniture. There's only just enough chairs and tables for people to use, and then everything else is just playing area for, as I say, this rather sort of knockabout comedy. So I thought it was an entertaining evening. I wouldn't score David Suchet highly for getting the character. And as I say, I think it works best for people who don't know the play in any other form, including the magnificent 1951 film. So, Nick, have I left anything for you to say? Or did you disagree?
I suppose I disagree in a way, but it's possibly good. Because it's not that I'm unfamiliar with the play, but I certainly haven't seen it as many times. And I think the thing is, a bit like last year, that one, you know, the elderly one coming along, there's just, you know, I mean, we've been listing dozens of productions, most of them actually in the West End. And so, you know, when it comes along, I never feel any particular urgency to go see it, because the next one will be, you know, they're like buses. So, but I, actually, when it came to this one, I had the impression that I'd last seen it 10 years ago. But then when I looked it up, it turned out it was 20 years ago. So I thought, okay, so it's probably about time to see it again. So I last saw it at the Old Vic, which I thought was 10 years ago and turns out to be 20. So I think for me, I suppose the trouble is, however long you've left it, it's one of those plays where the best lines are part of the consciousness. You're never quite fresh to it. And even you could see sometimes audience members kind of tensing up and getting excited because they could feel one of the big lines coming. So it's that kind of play where it's you know, entirely in the consciousness. But I don't know that I do think the play is fantastic. I don't know that it's good enough to get quite as many revivals as it does. So I think I probably did the right thing in staying away from it for a while, because then it feels fresh again. I go to the Globe a lot, and I'd been aware of Philip Cumbers even before that, and he is somebody who can, without appearing to be trying to steal the show, he can steal a show very easily, and I think that's what he does here. You know, for me, he is the best performance in this. I don't know that I agree about David Suchet being kind of such a stranger to the West End. I mean, just looking through, it was 2012 he did Long Day's Journey Into Night, and it was only a year or two before that he did, was it All My Sons, at the same theatre. So I don't think he's, I know obviously for a lot of people he is just Poirot, but I don't think, for me, that's not kind of what I see him as. I think he's somebody who's done quite a good job of making people remember that he's not just the one character he's best known as. So I'm not crazy about that, especially because we've been hearing so much in the last couple of years about the kind of discrepancy of roles for men and women, particularly older women. I'm not kind of convinced about giving one of these kind of most iconic roles for older women to a man. But as I say, I haven't been kind of seeing every production for the last 20 years to compare with. So I found the fact that I think it obviously is something that he just really wanted to do, because that's very apparent from his performance. He does look like he's having the time of his life, and I think that's quite infectious. I think it's probably not the greatest production of the play that you'll ever see, but I think if you're going kind of along the way that I do and don't kind of see it quite as often as it becomes available, I think it's still an entertaining one.
I was going to mention the fact that John wasn't quite right about the things that David Suchet has done. I've seen him actually quite a lot. It's almost every couple of years he does the theatre. Did a very good Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf with Diana Rigg in the late 90s, or the mid-90s, which was rather interesting. And of course, thinking about his co-star in Long Day's Journey Into Night a couple of years ago, I couldn't help thinking I'd love to see Laurie Metcalf's take on Lady Bracknell. That would be a lot of fun. But I agree with what most people have been saying. It is an overacted production, I think. There is far too much playing to the gallery. And I was actually up in the gallery and with my very powerful opera glasses, where they have to be almost within kissing distance to get two people in the sights. And the amount of mugging going on I found very, very distracting. But it has to be said, everybody around me was having an extremely good time, I think. We're just thinking it wonderful. I thought it was, they were overacting, they were telegraphing, they were mugging all the time. I agree that Michael Benz was just wrong as Jack Worthing. He looks too young, and he had no dignity to him and no gravitas. I thought in the other ones it was just, you know, they've been told to play about by the director, and it spoiled it, because it could have been really quite good. And, you know, David Suchet's okay, but again, he's trying to impose things onto it he said in an interview that Lady Bracknell is some kind of interloper. There is a particular line, and I'm always suspicious whenever you build around a particular line, but there is a particular line in the play where she says, "I had no fortune when I married Lord Bracknell." Well, yes, she didn't have a fortune. Algy doesn't have a fortune. She's posh but poor. She's not a chorus girl, or she's not somebody, you know, somebody who is working class. And if you're going to do that, then Julie Walters or Anne Reed, please, in the part. So I didn't think he was right. I mean, he was okay as it and did it, but he never stopped. You never stop thinking that it was David Suchet. But I think everybody enjoyed it, and it has got fairly decent reviews. I think some of them were 3 stars, but I don't think there's any really bad reviews for this. So it's solid, but I don't think it's a really great production. And I'm still waiting to see that great production. There must be one out there somewhere, something that's going to beat the film. We're now going to talk about I Love You, You're Perfect, Now Change at the Arts Theatre, upstairs at the Arts Theatre. This is a musical, it's a series of sort of comic musical sketches, really, rather than a whole musical. And it looks at the whole panoply of love and relationships, going from those first tentative steps, thinking you're always going to be alone, all the way to old age and trying to hook up with somebody at a funeral. It's got music by Jimmy Roberts and book and lyrics by Joe DiPietro. I've heard of this musical quite a few times. It seems to be something that groups of musical theatre stars get together and do in upstairs rooms for short runs, because, you know, I've seen one or two mentions of it before. This one attracted me, and I think attracted one or two other people in the know, because of the presence of Julie Atherton and Simon Lipkin in the productions. I saw a rather interesting production of Shock Treatment, the follow-up to Rocky Horror, which was being done earlier this year at the King's Head, and Julie Atherton was in that, and really very impressive, I thought. But that might be because she put her head in my lap during the production. Simon Lipkin, of course, was in Assassins earlier this year, and a rather interesting production of As You Like It at the Southwark Playhouse last year, where he got to practice his puppetry skills, which goes back to where I was first introduced to Julie Atherton and Simon Lipkin when they were both in Avenue Q. They are joined by Gina Beck and Samuel Holmes. Nick, tell me more about this and what you thought of it.
It might actually be the first time I've seen Simon Lipkin in something that didn't at any point involve a puppet. Even managed to get one into Assassins, which was quite impressive. So it's a little musical review show based generally around relationships. And as you say, it kind of, the structure of the show does sort of start with dating and builds up. By the interval, there's a wedding. And so then afterwards, it's kind of married life and either sort of the relationships lasting into old age or kind of ending in divorce, or you get a few kind of family sketches where the couple are now parents and they're trying to kind of fit their lives around the kids. I thought this was fun. I have as well, I've not seen it before, but I have so many times seen that it has been produced and not got around to seeing it. And again, it was the cast, especially the reuniting of Julie Atherton and Simon Lipkin. I mean, Julie Atherton is somebody you don't kind of miss if humanly possible. And that they are, I mean, they're very good musical theatre performers and very, they've both got kind of excellent comic timing. But the other two who are less familiar to me, but I think they've done a few of kind of the bigger West End shows, they're also very good and they're very funny. And the songs are fun. There's maybe not a lot of kind of hugely memorable ones, but then I think everyone says that after every musical, I think, you know, it's hard to come out of a completely fresh to you show and remembering any of the songs when you've kind of heard a dozen or so new songs for just the once. So they may actually be catchier than I thought at first, but they are funny. And I don't know that I would rush to see another production of it. I think possibly the popularity of it is that it's quite an easy one to stage. You just need 4 actors and couple of tables and chairs and you're there. But it is very funny, but I don't know that it would be quite as funny on repeated viewings. So I think the highlight for me was a scene near the end of the first act where a load of singles get taken to a prison to get lectured on dating by the sort of convicted killer who's Lipkin playing him. And I don't know whether kind of the physical tick that he gives him is scripted or whether that's something that has been added for this performance, but it's very funny and it's for me absolutely the highlight of the show. But there are a lot of fun sketches and a lot of fun songs along the way. Not sure about the venue. It's not great for sight lines. I think even in the front row, if anybody goes remotely off center from the stage, you're kind of craning your neck to try and see anything. But it's a fun little show.
Before we get to Gareth, I would like to... I had forgotten whether I'd seen Gina Beck in before. I've looked her up now, and she was in The Bell Stratagem at the Southwark Playhouse. This was a very impressive show directed by Jessica Swale some years ago, and she was one of the leading actors in that, and she was very memorable. And in fact, I think of the four actors in this piece, her voice was easily the best. I mean, it's almost operatic in some cases, and she's a very impressive voice. Julie Atherton, for all I like her as a comedian, I find her voice a little bit Broadway cutesy for my taste, but, you know, she's always worth watching. I think we always seek her. Anyway, Gareth, tell me more about this and what you thought of it.
Well, this show has been avoiding me for quite a while as well. I'm not quite sure why, because in addition to the few London runs, it's also been in Edinburgh a few times, but I've never actually caught it. What drew me to go and see this was also the fine casting, because I thought, wow, you know, this is four of our best young musical theatre people here. So that was the big draw for me on this. And I did enjoy it. I think the songs are okay. I think they're particularly good lyrically. And I think it's a funny show. And I guess that surprised me quite a bit, because I wasn't expecting it to be quite so funny. I think it's particularly well performed here. Julie Atherton, who I've seen quite a bit, apart from Avenue Q, I've really only seen in serious stuff. And I was very sort of surprised, pleasantly surprised, at her gift for comedy as well, because I really thought that was the strength of the show for all of them. But I thought in particular for her, it was a bit of a revelation for me. Gina Beck, I'd recently seen in Jacques Brel, and I, again, hadn't seen her in anything comic, so I think she handled the comedy very well. Simon Lipkin, I know better for comedy, and he was one of the best things about I Can't Sing, the ill-fated X Factor musical, because he played Barlow the dog with a puppet again on that occasion. So I thought it was a very enjoyable evening. You know, it's the tunes are sort of good enough, not necessarily memorable. It's a very archetypal American show, you know, four actors and a piano. There are loads of these four actors and a piano American shows, reviews, song cycles, whatever you want to call them. But it's, you know, in that kind of market, it's probably better than average, largely because I think it does kind of somehow get into, through the humor, get into the sort of the truth, life's twists and turns, really. But particularly because it's so well performed by this crack cast. I just completely took against the venue. I mean, I did manage to get a seat in the front row, but on the side. But I mean, it was just hot. It was, I mean, there's no raking, no stage, as I've said. I mean, it's just not a venue I liked at all. And I was just sitting there thinking, you know, this is too good to be here. It needs to be in somewhere like the Union or the Landor or the St. James's Studio. You know, it just needs a longer run and a better theatre. But that said, I certainly don't regret going to see it and catching up with it at last, you know, with such great performances.
We're now going to talk about The Red Lion at the Dorfman Theatre, part of the National. This is a new play by Patrick Marber. I think it's first for quite a long time. He's done a few adaptations. He revamped Trelawney of the Wells in 2012 at the Donmar and is doing an adaptation of Turgenev's Month in the Country called 3 Days in the Country at the National opening in a week or so. This play is sort of the second of his plays that's been on this year, The Red Lion, because we had the big Donmar revival of Closer earlier this year, which was rather impressive in many ways. I'm not certain that this one is quite so much. This is a play about a football club, a semi-pro football club, non-league football club, which is struggling to make money, and it really focuses on three people. An old star footballer who's fallen on hard times and has been sort of rehabilitated as the kit man, that's played by Peter White. Then you have Calvin Dember as a rather promising young footballer who may be able to save the club in some way. And then you have the wide boy manager played by Daniel Mays. Now, I know, Gareth, you're a big fan of Daniel Mays. I can't say I am. I think he's played far too many unpleasant characters for me really to like him. He's probably an extremely nice person in real life. So tell me more about this play, Gareth, and what you thought of it.
Well, I am a big fan of Daniel Mays, but I'm also a big fan of Patrick Marber. I mean, he's not a prolific playwright, but everything I've seen by him, I've enjoyed very much. And seeing the revival of Closer at the Donmar that you just mentioned quite recently did kind of remind me how well written his plays are. So my starting point was, oh, good, a new Patrick Marber play. Because, you know, he has only done, well, I've only seen Dealer's Choice and Closer in terms of original plays, and then after Miss Julie and Don Juan in Soho in terms of sort of adaptations. But the adaptations are so radical that one might consider them, you know, his play. Well, one would consider him his plays anyway. And what he's done this time is he's gone into this world, as you say, of semi-professional football. Well, I think I probably have to say at the outset, I'm not really that interested in football, so it might be worth saying that. And we spend the whole time in the changing room. And one of the problems with that is that we only have these three characters. It kind of cries out, really, for more characters, given that kind of setting. Daniel Mays plays this manager kid, who's a bit of a spiv. And, you know, but having said that, he seems to have turned the team around. The kid man, as you mentioned, you know, has kind of fallen on hard times. But he's a bit of a father figure and does command sort of respect and indeed love. And then you've got this new player, Jordan, who seems to be very promising. The biggest problem with the play for me is that the first act, which is 50 minutes long, just does nothing. All it does really is introduce you to these characters and set the scene. And by the interval, you know, you're thinking, you know, what is this? And the night I went, which was just before the opening night, I think, an awful lot of people didn't come back for the second act. And that quite surprised me. I didn't think it was, you know, that bad. I returned the second act. But I think that tells you something about the slowness of this first act. It did get better. You know, when you got back in the second act, it did get better because we now move into the sort of the proper story, which is the kind of murkier side of football, really. And then we sort of see people on the make and you know, people who seem to be more interested in business and money than indeed sport, which I've always thought was the big issue of football in modern times anyway, that is more of a business than a sport anyway. And this new boy, this new player is clearly a commodity, really. I mean, he's seen as being someone who could make the money or make individuals and indeed make the club money. And it basically, you know, all comes home to roost, really. The only really honest person in the play proves to be John the Kidman. But it does have a very melodramatic ending. So my problem with the play is the first act, the pacing of the play, the fact it was underpopulated by characters, and then a somewhat melodramatic ending. So it was a bit of a disappointment for me, to be honest, because when I compare that with things like Closer and Dealer's Choice, it's just nowhere near in the same league. And so much care has been put on the play. You know, Anthony Ward's, you know, created a really brilliant, realistic, high-ceiling dressing room with all the sort of little details. Peter White has given, for me, one of the best performances of his career. I've seen him lots and lots and lots of times, and he's never been better than this. I am a big fan of Daniel Mays, though I have to say, I did think he probably overplayed it a bit on this occasion. And Calvin Dember, I mean, we saw him quite recently in a play that was also not very good called Wolf at the Door at the Royal Court. So I'd really like to see him in a good play and a better role, really. So it was a disappointment for me. And in a way, because Patrick Marber apparently is very into semi-professional football, you know, one might expect him perhaps to be too close to the subject, to be entirely objective about it. But, you know, the director is Ian Rickson, and one would have expected Ian Rickson to kind of to balance that and sort of say, well, hang on a minute, have we got this right here? So I thought it was a disappointing play, and the first time I've been disappointed by Patrick Marber's work, and a great pity because so much talent has gone into making it. And the crux of that disappointment is this first act, because it never really recovers from it. So that's where I am on it.
Yeah, I have to say about Peter White, he is one of the most impressive actors I ever see, and he is always a reason. If you see him at a cast list, he is almost a reason to book for the play sight unseen. Always delivers an excellent performance. He's one of he's one of those actors who does, and he does a fair bit, but always in the background. He's not really got on television in film, but there is a real power to him, that kind of bottled up emotion and that he exudes, and it's very, very strong. And I've seen him in some amazing things in the past, and it's a pity that this isn't quite as good as that. So, Nick, what do you think about The Red Lion?
I think for me, because we've recently had the revival of Closer at the Donmar, which was obviously Petra Marva's probably biggest theatre hit, at least, kind of I'd be reminded of just how misanthropic he can be. And I think that's very apparent in this as well. And for me, it kind of becomes problematic, because although there is a sort of little ray of someone who's not completely awful in Peter White's character, there's obviously been this long gap in Petra Marva's writing career, and apparently he spent it largely dealing with a football club like this, but he certainly hasn't spent it cheering up about what he thinks about the human race, because he clearly still doesn't think much of them. And I think that is largely, for me, that the problem with this, it's so misanthropic, it's so kind of negative. There's kind of little touches of humour, but not really very much. And I think it's just very difficult to really care about, because you've got kind of these unpleasant characters doing unpleasant things and being sort of utterly selfish and out for themselves. I think you do get a couple of good performances in there. I think, obviously, yes, Peter White is excellent and has a couple of very moving moments, although I don't, again, I think the way his story kind of goes is bleak and dark for the sake of it. And again, I think Calvin Denver is really promising. He's given some very good performances in some not very good plays. I think give him the right part in the right play, and he's really somebody who I think is going to shine in the next few years. So yeah, I don't have a huge amount more than that to add. It's not terrible, but it's hard to really like, is how I felt about this one, really.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast page of Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com, and the podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you, goodbye.